Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will process ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce our special guest, Dr. Eric Wilmarth. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm great. I've been hoping to have you on the show for a long time. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. Dr. Wilmarth is a clinical psychologist specializing in chronic pain and other long-term medical conditions. He completed his master's degree in clinical psychology at Eastern Michigan University in 1977. And then he returned for a PhD in clinical psychology from Fielding University in 1999. He is a full professor at Seabrook University, where he serves as the chair of the Department of Applied Psychophysiology in the College of Integrative Medicine and Health Sciences. He's past president of the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis, and served twice as the president of the Society for Psychological Hypnosis, which is the American Psychological Association's Division 30, and he did not succeed in unifying all three societies. And he's fascinated with the history of hypnosis and has authored and co-authored a number of book chapters and articles in the field of hypnosis and biofeedback. Over the years, Eric has video recorded many of the leading hypnosis clinicians and researchers, and many of these interviews can be found on YouTube. And that's at also at www.hypnosiscentral.com. And if you have not listened to some of these interviews, I highly recommend them because you interviewed me, I think, 20 years ago or so, but a lot of very important people have shared their knowledge with us through the Wilmarth interviews. So again, welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much.
So much to talk about. I guess a lot of young people listen to this radio broadcast because I work with adolescents, young adults, and I often like to start by asking, how did you get into your career? How did you become a psychologist?
Well, you know, I was a music major as an undergraduate, and I had a double major with social relations, which is kind of a combination of sociology and psychology through William James College. And at some point I decided I really didn't want to try to make a living playing the bassoon. And at the time I remembered I loved reading case histories. I could do that all day long, and so that seemed like a natural field to go into, and that's kind of what led me into getting my master's degree in clinical psychology. And so I spent my first 5 years working at a child guidance clinic, and then moved to working with a staff model HMO, which is where I first got really involved with both hypnosis and biofeedback in the medical setting. And after 5 years of that, I got into the pain management field. I was recruited because of my biofeedback and hypnosis background, and I worked for that group for 36 years.
So back up a little bit. I'm still not sure about the step between being a bassoon player and clinical psychology. How did that step happen?
Well, you find an awful lot of music majors went on into medical school or law or something like that. I think there's certainly so many advantages of music in terms of its impact neurophysiologically, and I think the creativity and the flexibility that music training provides makes a lot of other opportunities out there. I was just drawn to the stories. When you read a case history of someone, it's basically a story, a short autobiography of someone in some specific time and place. And that's always appealed to me. Even to this day, I love doing initial evaluations because, you know, you're meeting somebody for the first time and you're getting to hear their story and hopefully have some skills that you can use to help improve their life in some way.
Where did you encounter stories? Did you go to a lecture? Did you talk to your peers? How did you encounter stories in the first place?
Well, in the first place, it was in the textbooks, I'm sure, at William James College, you know, reading stories, and, you know, books would include case histories, trying to make their points, on that. And then, you know, my first job, was at a child guidance clinic, and of course, you know, we're getting stories both from the children and from the parents in that kind of a setting, so. But I think it was, you know, originally it was, you know, in graduate school, in the textbooks, or even an undergraduate, you know, in the psychology classes, there's a certain appeal to me to those stories, and I guess that's followed me my whole career.
Wow. So, is there a particular story from the child guidance days that still sticks with you?
Well, one thing that sticks with me is that I've since seen some of the grandchildren of people who were originally my patients as children, which makes me start to feel really old. I think there's so many things, child guidance clinic, that you don't always see kids at their best when they're being brought to a clinic like that, and yet when you go into another classroom and see, you know, 30 students sitting there well-behaved, you know, doing their work without constant supervision, it kind of reminds you of the range of experience that students go through, and the attention spans and things like that. That was really before my hypnosis days. That really started when I got into the medical type of thing. But, you know, as any young therapist, you know, the patients teach us more than we're probably able to teach them. I was always curious as to how anybody, you know, that coming in their 40s with four kids would take any advice from a 20-something or other, and yet that never seemed to bother the patient. I think it was only, you know, my own imposter syndrome that kicked in when you're in that first job.
And so did you get a sense, wondering about those kids who were having trouble fitting in, was it, I know it was nature and nurture, but did you get a sense it was more one of the other? What made some kids tick so differently?
Well, you're right. You know, it is both nature and nurture involved, and, you know, I think both of those are sliding scales. On some, it was probably primarily an environmental situation that they were in. Others, it seemed clearly to be a biological basis for what was going on. So I think if you see two bars, you know, the scale on each one of them can slide in any given case. You can probably put where the mix is. You know, we talk about it in theory. It always seems like people talking about a 50-60 mix, and I doubt that that's ever true. I think it's probably more of one and less of one in every situation. But basically, you start with wherever they are and see what immediate things you can do to help make things better.
So as a child guidance counselor, what would you do at that point? And I'm going to ask you, after you answer that, how would you treat that same child differently now with all of your tools of biofeedback and hypnosis? What did you do with a child who was acting out and there was biological factors and at-home factors? What kind of guidance did you give back then?
Well, I think all along through my career, the primary tool has been relationship. You know, finding a way to form a relationship with both the child and the parent. You know, and some of it comes down to basic advice giving. Some of it gives the amount of change that simply attention can provide to someone. I'm sure back then I was probably much more you know, recently trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, so I'm sure there were probably techniques like that I used in the setting. But I think overall, probably effectiveness-wise, it was, you know, would depend on my ability to form a relationship with the patient and get their cooperation in terms of seeing what they could do to empower themselves to make changes. Today, you know, hypnosis certainly would be a valuable tool that I didn't have back then. you know, in terms of helping empower the client to be able to find their own inner strengths and their abilities. So I think I probably went to the same technique using CBT types of approaches. I certainly would combine that with hypnosis today, and probably, you know, I think that's much more empowering than probably straight CBT would be without hypnosis.
Can you give us an example of a CBT technique and a specific example of how you teach a child hypnosis?
Well, like I said, that was before my hypnosis days, and you know, I've certainly been to a lot of courses on pediatric hypnosis since that time, and you certainly wouldn't expect a child to be sitting there calmly with their hands folded or, you know, in a sleep-like state, because they tend to wiggle and move and all sorts of other approaches. But, you know, imagination is useful with or without hypnosis, so if they can imagine a situation that they would like better than the situation they're in, and then we can kind of analyze what are their thoughts, and can we look at those thoughts and see whether those are something that could be altered in a way that would make them feel better. Hypnosis certainly would be a much more powerful way to allow them to use imagery and to make changes. I would probably have them, you know, viewing a movie screen or something of that nature, and, you know, allow them to star in their own movie and to be able to change that as they wanted to. Like I said, I keep using the word empowering, but I think that's one of the main features of hypnosis. It allows people to change the rules, to expand on the possibilities, and then start to believe in possibilities that they might not have considered before.
And what would you do with a difficult child today who's not interested in learning that? How do you approach that child?
Well, today, since I worked with adults for the last 40 years, I would probably refer them on to someone who specialized in children, like Ron Ambar or someone like that. But again, hypnosis is a power that's within the patient, not the hypnotist. So, you know, it would so go back to being able to form a relationship, getting them to consider the possibility of exploring. You know, I don't know how much ability they have, and certainly they wouldn't know without it being texted out. So if I get them to play, to practice, to see whether it's something that they were or weren't able to do, I think a lot of times resistant patients, adults as well, you know, kind of make it a challenge of whether, you know, the old phrase, I bet you can't hypnotize me, you know, and the reverse is true. It's like, you know, I know certainly I've been successful in helping a number of patients, but we don't know what their ability is. So we really, you know, turn it back over to the curiosity, because we really don't know what type of ability they may or may not have. And if you can get them curious enough to find out what they can do and get it away from a power struggle of me doing something to them, I think that's, you know, the best approach to go at it.
Cool. So shifting gears, I know you do a lot of work with chronic pain, and you mentioned before biofeedback and hypnosis. Can you give us an overview, like, how do you assess, I know this is a really big question, but how do you assess the patient's pain, and then how do you decide whether to do biofeedback or hypnosis or both? And also, I'm going to ask you to explain what biofeedback is.
Sure.
Not everybody understands that.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, in assessment, we start off with the foundational thought that pain is real if you feel it. I think patients sometimes get over-psychologized, and they come in asking, I'm wondering if it's all in their heads, but, you know, pain is an experience. We may or may not know the etiology of it, or it may or may not show up on x-rays, but the pain itself, we assume, is a real pain. Biofeedback doesn't do anything to you. It basically gives you information. So there are actually lots of different forms of biofeedback. You know, in my office, EMG, or electromyogram biofeedback, measures muscle tension. One of the problems with chronic pain is they tend to guard and brace, and so you end up with people with very tight muscles that are not always aware that they're tightening up certain muscles. So biofeedback can be, you know, you can hook up electrodes on the muscles, and they can see on a computer screen exactly how relaxed or how tight a muscle is. Galvanic skin response is probably more of a measure of emotional well-being if they're calm or anxious. And again, they can see on the screen, this scores go up or down. You can get somebody who's fairly relaxed, and if you ask them a question such as, do you mind if I ask you something personal, within 3 seconds that line will go off the screen because they'll already be worrying about what are you going to ask them and things like that. So if you want to demonstrate a mind-body connection, the galvanic skin response is a really quick way to show that, just their thoughts cause a major physiological change. Went from the ear to their fingertips within 3 seconds and changing the perspiration that, is a nice conductor of electricity. We can also check breathing rate. Blood pressure would also be a measure of that could be checked with biofeedback. Neurofeedback would be checking brainwave activities. So you could look at the how much alpha, how much beta, how much theta was going on. So, again, the biofeedback equipment itself doesn't do anything to the patient, but it gives information. It's a lot easier to change something when you see it happening in real time. So if we hook up the shoulders and see that it's kicking out, say, 15 microvolts, and in a relaxed state would be about 1 microvolt, they can see that in real time. They can sometimes play games on the video or whatever it takes to give you some progressive muscle relaxing, tension relaxing, and they can see what effect that has on it, too. And then at that point, hopefully memorize what it feels like to have the muscles relaxed, because so often people, when they're guarding and bracing, don't even know they're doing it. You ask them to tighten their shoulders, and they're surprised when they find they can't because they're already locked up nice and tight. So, in terms of an evaluation, it's nice to at least let them see some of the physiology in real time, demonstrate how the mind and body interact and how it can change things, and again, let them see that they have the ability to make the change. But so often patients come in feeling somewhat helpless or over-dependent on the doctor fixing me, as opposed to looking at self-regulation, which is our key theme in both biofeedback and hypnosis. I kind of look at those as the twin pillars of self-regulation, teaching the patient how to be able to change their own thoughts, how to change their own physiology, and improve the situation. A lot of what I do in my office is simply talk therapy, but most patients get a chance to at least try hypnosis to see whether that's going to be something that's going to be a valuable tool for them to learn. A number of them would also have a biofeedback assessment so they can actually see what's going on physiologically.
How do you decide what you're going to offer a particular patient?
A little bit would depend on what they're coming for. Usually they're being referred here by a physician, because of pain. And so, the first part, again, forming a relationship on it, somewhat of it, the personality of the patient involved. There are some people who would be spooked by the word hypnosis and have some objection, whether it's religious or otherwise, to doing it, that they want things, but they might also be very enamored about the science of a computer and electrodes and being able to see the physiology. There are others that would be completely opposite of that. They'd be scared of the wires and the computer and all that mystical stuff, but fascinated by something that might be their own abilities, so they might be much more drawn to hypnosis. Hypnosis of the two is the simpler. There's no equipment involved. The trance state is such a normal, natural state that they've already been in, throughout their lives, that once we can dispel some of the myths and some of the things, and if they're willing to try it, that would be my initial go-to. If they're able to use that, then I may also, want to add the information that they could get from the biofeedback and combine those two things. So, like I said, our goal is self-regulation. Either one of those or both of them combined could be valuable, but my natural leaning would be towards hypnosis first.
What's the range of effectiveness of hypnosis for pain? Like, what might a patient expect or see?
Well, that's the fun part of the curiosity, because I've certainly had patients who, within one session in my office, go from, extreme pain ratings to saying that they don't have no pain at all. Those are the ones you like to have. They're not certainly the majority, but a number of years ago, I was on a had a patient where the TV station showed up at the pain clinic, and the director knocked on my door and said, Channel 17's here. They want to do something on pain. I told them we'd do hypnosis. Who you got? And the patient that I had in the room was one who initially had been really resistant to doing hypnosis, and then when he finally gave up and tried it, it turned out to be very gifted, and went from, you know, pain in the 9 and 10 range to no pain at all. So he's made a lovely TV news broadcast saying things like, you know, I have no idea why, but the pain is gone. So you do have those miracle sessions where they've got the ability to completely alter it. Most people I find have ability to change something about the aspect of pain, usually somewhat the intensity. Some of them can change the location. Sometimes it's less about the physical sensation and pain, and sometimes it's about reducing the anxiety and the worry about it, so that it's still there, but it doesn't bother them. So there are a number of different approaches to pain. There's a sensory and an affective component to it, and hypnosis can be used to address either or both.
And how about biofeedback? What do you see?
Well, again, in biofeedback, my main goal at first biofeedback session was to demonstrate to them the mind-body connection. And so, again, if you hook up someone, just a couple of fingertips that you hook up with galvanic skin response or skin resistance, they can watch the go up and down as they begin to relax, and as it relaxes, you'll see the line come down to fairly flat level. And that's when you ask them something, mildly stressful, and they can see on the screen the line jump, even though they don't feel anything different. But it's a great demonstration to show that your thoughts affect the physiology. Within 3 seconds, changing the electrical signals, the sweat in your fingertips. And so I think demonstrating that they have that ability is a really good starting place for them to believe that they can make change.
And this is fascinating stuff. I'm eager to ask you more questions about biofeedback and hypnosis and treatment of pain. We'll do so right after the break. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, CenterPoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterPointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our special guest, Dr. Eric Willemarth. We're talking about working with patients who have pain. So do you ever use biofeedback alone, like not with hypnosis, to help treat pain?
Yeah, certainly. There are patients who, for one reason or another, are either afraid of hypnosis or would refuse to do hypnosis, or possibly that hypnosis really wasn't very helpful to them. And so biofeedback can be a standalone adjunctive treatment to psychotherapy. We treat both biofeedback and hypnosis as adjunctive techniques as opposed to therapy in and of themselves. But certainly if you want to train someone to control excessive muscle tension, if you're trying to get them to learn better pacing on their breathing, biofeedback by itself can provide them that information. And it's usually combined a lot with home practice, having them try different things at home and then being able to measure how much change has been recorded when they come back and get measured again.
What I understand you're saying is that, you know, you'll measure, let's say, their muscle tension and show them how their thoughts can affect it. But what instruction do you give them to help them relax their muscle tension?
Well, you know, it's one of the things, you know, we've all used progressive muscle relaxation before, but with biofeedback, you can see exactly why. Because when you tense up a muscle and hold it for 5 seconds and then let go, it usually comes back down lower than it was when you started, you know, below your initial baseline, so that they can see that, you know, there was tension there even before they tensed up. And then my normal instructions to them would be to tense up fairly tight for 5 seconds and then relax for 10 seconds and then tense up half as much for 5 seconds and relax for 10 and then half as much again. So kind of graduating so that they're able to start to identify levels of tension. And each time they can see on the screen exactly how much, in this case, electrical activity is going on. And so, you know, we don't measure pain itself, but we can measure things like muscle tension, how much electrical activity is being expended. And so, you know, as they practice things like progressive muscle relaxation, they can see the results on it. They can go home and practice. And when they come back again, we can go through the same setting and they can see, you know, if now their baseline is 10 rather than 15, they know that they've made progress during the week. There are also sometimes some home units we can send people that you can set a threshold so that anytime it starts to go, say, above 10, it'll vibrate or beep. I can remember I had one woman who, you know, went back to the factory to work, and when she came back again, I asked her how the biofeedback had worked, and she said, oh, I took it off. It was beeping all the time. Which just meant that she was constantly tense there and had kind of missed the point of why it was set that way. But usually try to set a threshold that's within their grasp of getting it, and then as they improve, you lower the threshold a little bit so that, yeah, they're always at a point where they can have some success, but not so low that, you know, it's something that they don't have to continue working on. So you gradually guide them down to where they need to be.
So if muscle tension is a contributing source of pain, do you ever recommend other therapies to help with that, like Reiki or myofascial release or acupuncture, stuff like that?
Well, yeah, I've always had the luxury up until, you know, just this year, of having physical therapy right in the pain clinic where I worked. So a lot of times they would be involved with that. I'm a strong advocate of massage. We do have several acupuncture practitioners, one that worked in the practice and others that worked around it. So a lot of times patients will choose their own adjunctive techniques to go along with it, but physical therapy we had built in so that they could work on stretches, and particularly if they've been injured in a car accident or at work or things like that, there may be some instruction needed how not to re-injure themselves and how to carefully, it's not a time to go to the gym and say more is better because they could injure themselves. And so, physical therapy really becomes a really key part of a pain management program in that sense.
And if we can go back for a moment to the TV star hypnosis patient whose pain improved dramatically, do you remember why he was resistant to hypnosis and what turned the tide with him?
I do remember. I mean, every once in a while you have a patient on your schedule when you look at the name and you groan, and he was one of those who had been really difficult to work with. He was seemed like kind of a bully to the other therapists before I saw him. I remember when he first walked into my office and he saw a book on hypnosis on my bookshelf, he said, "We're not going to do that voodoo crap." And so it was, the first 3 weeks I saw him, everything that I suggested was either stupid or he'd already done it. Like, kind of, what else you got? So very intimidating, very hard to deal with. I was getting ready to pull the plug saying I think I was going to agree with him, that there's nothing I can do to help. But I think he anticipated that, and that's why he finally agreed to try the hypnosis, because I think he knew that I was kind of at the end of my rope. I think, talk about seeing cognitive dissonance in real time, when he first brought him out of hypnosis, he said some naughty words and repeated them over and over again, and my first assumption was, well, that didn't work. But what was going on was he was experiencing no pain, and yet he didn't believe in hypnosis. So that cognitive dissonance was written all over his face. But he did come back the next week and was much nicer to work with. He turned out to be a really nice guy, but living in pain in 10 years doesn't really do much to improve your personality. So that is still up on YouTube somewhere if someone wants to look for it. If you put in Wilmarth and hypnosis, eventually you'll see that in there. But he was a very bright guy. He'd been a plumber for his career before he got hurt. He did 4 back surgeries prior to my meeting him. He was a good example of gifted in hypnotic ability. And once he tried it, even though he didn't believe in it, that didn't seem to make the difference. That having the ability was the more important feature there. Every once in a while, you'll see and somebody say, "Well, you have to believe in hypnosis in order to work." I don't think that's always true. I think sometimes hypnotic ability supersedes what we put over it. On the other hand, a few years later, his brother hurt himself carrying some chains or something or other and came back, and everything was different. My expectations were much higher because they certainly weren't very high with this first patient. His expectations were high because of what went on with his brother, and actually we made no impact at all with hypnosis with the brother. So even though there does tend to be a genetic predisposition, I think, passed along in hypnotic ability. It goes back to the curiosity. You never know with the next patient where they're going to fall on that line, how much benefit they'll get for not. But one was a complete surprise. Actually, they were both complete surprises, one in a good way and one in not such a good way.
I encourage our audience to look up your interviews at www.hypnosiscentral.com. There's a lot of really cool interviews there. And I'm hoping after the break, if you could tell us about one or two of your most interviews that made the biggest impression on you. And tell us also how many people have you interviewed approximately. Because it really is an amazing library of knowledge and wisdom that people can gain access to in the Wilmarth interviews. We'll be right back. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens, harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar, a special guest, Dr. Eric Willemarth, who has spent years documenting what luminaries in the hypnosis field have to say about their most interesting cases. And I was wondering if you could share with us some of the most interesting stories you've heard.
Okay. Well, you know, one of my interesting, Erica Fromm, who was, you know, extensive researcher and clinician using hypnosis at the University of Chicago, trained, you know, probably half the people in the United States in hypnosis at one point or during her career. I interviewed her when she was in her 90s, and she told the story of how she first got exposed to hypnosis, and it was... she was in charge of putting the APA meeting together, and they did a survey of what people wanted, and hypnosis came up in the top three, and her response was, you know, hypnosis is for the birds, that kind of thing we are not going to do. But because she had proposed it, they made her do it, and then she went to the workshop, which John Watkins gave, and was so converted into the hypnosis, not only for therapy but for research, that you know, that triggered her whole career. So, you know, it's interesting that all through the history of hypnosis, some of the biggest detractors, once they actually, you know, look at the field, become some of its greatest advocates. And so she's in a long line of those. Clinically, there's this guy named Ron Bonbar who tells an amazing story about one of his cases, but I guess I'll let you tell that story on your own show rather than go on. Dr. Dan Handel was working with hospice and tells a very heart-wrenching story about a young woman who, with cerebral palsy, who developed throat and neck cancer and was in hospice when he first met her. And she had a large tumor that was blocking off the venous return, so it was kind of like the Elephant Man. If she got out of vertical, it would, you know, she'd start to turn blue. And he was called on his lunch hour to go see what he could do for her, and said that he was amazed very quickly that she was highly hypnotizable. He was able to make suggestions that the inside of her mind would be allow her to sleep in a vertical position, and that anytime she got out of vertical, it would automatically adjust. And so it allowed her to sleep well, to do some very important business that she had to do, and she lived about 2 weeks. And he said when they found her, when she died, she had bled out, but she had put red towels around herself so it wouldn't scare the other people. And he said they found her smiling with her symbol for going into trance, you know, with a smile on her face. And so, you know, a very powerful story about what impact hypnosis can have, even if it may not correct the underlying problem, but it will make some very, you know, large differences in the quality of life. There's also a story, I'm going to block on a name here, the forensic psychologist from Ohio, Webster. William Webster, yes, thank you.
Webster.
He used to do a lot of work with the FBI and sketch artists, interviewing people after crimes and putting them in trance and having them relive the moment so that they could describe the witnesses better or things. And he told a case how a girl had been kidnapped, and the FBI called him in very quickly, and he interviewed two people, an older man and a paper boy. And he didn't get much from the man, but the paper boy in trance was able to give him all sorts of detail, and instead of just a blue van, he was able to describe the van, the painting on the side, some stickers on it. And they said after that, they put out an APB. They got a phone call from another young man at a gas station that said, I don't know if it's the one, but it sounds like the description. They put up roadblocks, and they were able to stop the van at the next exit, and the girl was tied up in back, still safe. So, you know, Bill said that, you know, that kind of made his career in hypnosis, that he probably actually saved a life by using hypnosis. And he had a number of stories like that of descriptions that were so clear it was almost like a photograph with a sketch artist, where in one case the perpetrator saw his own picture on TV and knew the jig was up because of the quality of the thing. So it's you know, it's used medically, it's used forensically, you know, certainly used in psychotherapy. So it's been a fun over 30 years collecting all those little stories as they come up. Sometimes people will tell about some of the other famous hypnotists, some about their own stories, how they got involved with hypnosis. Eva Banyai, another pain one, talks about how she was at a nursing home just doing, I think, probably the early testing on the Stanford hypnosis scale. And she said she was young, she was in her doing an internship or something, and she literally read the script. And she said there's no specific suggestion for anesthesia in that. But she said as she was doing it, she could watch this person, you know, become very calm and relaxed. And afterwards, you know, he kissed her hand and thanked her because he felt that he could now die with dignity because he had this ability to reduce the pain, you know, without the use of morphine and stay conscious and things. So, and of course, she's crying as she's telling the story, and most people cry when they watch that story and I show it. So, hypnosis can be a real life changer for people in a lot of ways, even at the end of life.
Really wonderful stories. Again, people can find them at hypnosiscentral.com. So I'm wondering, and I want, if you were on the other end of the camera and somebody was doing a Wilmoth interview with you and ask you to tell a story, what you will tell, I'll caution you, our break is coming up, so you might have to stop for a break, but how would you answer that question? What story would you want to tell?
Well, yeah, again, I think we all have, like, as people tell me every time, there are hundreds of stories, but you know, one that stays in mind is a woman who was referred for headaches, but the doctor who referred her said that if you're going to use hypnosis, check out her eyesight, because she was blind, He was on disability because of blindness, but he said the eyes seem to track funny, and you know, it just seemed strange to me. So I knew even back then that you know, you probably just don't rip away symptoms without. So I made the suggestion that in a few moments, when she opened her eyes, she'll be able to see for a short time, and it won't last long, but I wanted her to look around the room and tell me what she saw. And to, I think, both of our amazements, when she opened her eyes, the first thing she said was, it's a bummer this isn't going to last very long. So she certainly heard my safety valve in there that this wasn't going to be a permanent removal of her symptom. But it did show that the eyes worked, you know, that it was a psychogenic blindness, not the physical one that she had been treated for by you know, ophthalmologists and while she was on disability. I asked her if it was all right if I went out to my car and got my video camera so we could do a little interview while she could still see, and she said yes. So that takes away any secondary gain issues. You know, if you're faking it, you wouldn't let somebody videotape you while you're able to see, but she was very happy to do the interview, and eventually, before the end of the session, the visions faded away. But it was certainly a case where hypnosis allowed to see, make a much better diagnosis in terms of why she was blind. And, you know, over the next several months in psychotherapy, she did get back her full vision. And, you know, there are lots of lovely psychodynamics about how she initially went blind when her husband hit her. And because he became the leader dog after that, he had to do everything and take her everywhere and do everything. But it was literally a case where the brain didn't know that the eyes could see. I was certainly excited right after that. I had to go up, look up anything I could find on psychogenic blindness, and there wasn't much, but this was a number of years ago. But you know, it just kind of reinforces the power of the brain to both heal and to harm us under trauma type situations. But 10 years later, I got she gave me a teddy bear with a paisley tie on because apparently that first thing she saw when she opened her eyes was I was wearing a paisley tie. So I think I still have that teddy bear.
This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis, or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California, and Syracuse, New York, This caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our special guest, Dr. Eric Wilmarth, who's shared with us a story that's well worth to be included in the Wilmarth archive. So, Eric, you've worked for many years in a number of fields and have talked to many luminaries, and I'm wondering, this segment of the show, I often ask guests to give three tips to our audience of things they can incorporate into their lives to help their lives better based on your experiences. So what three tips would you want to share with our audience?
Well, I guess the first tip would be to foster relationships. I think that, you know, psychotherapeutically, that's a key if you're working with a client, but I think in our personal lives, it's probably also a key that I don't think we're designed well to operate in isolation. And having a sense of community, having some affiliations, and that could be at a church or synagogue, it could be at a YMCA, it could be a neighborhood group, but I think, you know, having some kind of connection with other people is, you know, a key to healthy emotional life, and probably a physical plus as well. Number two, I guess, would be to take care of yourself. You know, so often we put ourselves last on the list of all those things that have to be done, and, you know, our own self-care is something that gets put on a shelf that says, I'll do that when I have time. And yet it's such a key part of the ability to help others depends on our ability to stay healthy ourselves. So I think, you know, taking good care of yourself would be the second tip. I'm not really sure what the third tip would be, other than to laugh, to enjoy music, to seek positivity. There's so much stress in the world and things. I think sometimes we get too focused on it, and we miss the little heartwarming experience that's around us every day. So, you know, I guess the third tip would be to look for positive moments, enjoy art and music and humor. All of those things, I think, help sustain us in our life.
So I think those tips are great. So fostering relationship, taking care of yourself, and finding joy and positivity in life. I think those are key throughout the lifespan, from teenage years to old age. I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit more information. How do you establish a relationship? A lot of the people I counsel, they feel lonely, they feel disconnected. Do you have any tips for you give your clients to how they can be more responsive?
Well, one of the things, you know, I've worked with a great group of doctors for 30-plus years, and, you know, one of the things I kept hearing patients say when they came in, you know, why they like their doctors so much is because they listen. And my first thought was, isn't that sad that a doctor who listens would be abnormal? But again, I've had doctors who probably had their hand on the doorknob when I was trying to tell them something, and they're, you know, ready to rush away. So, I learned from that the first step in the relationship is actually listening to what the person has to say. And sometimes I think we get too enamored with our own knowledge, and we want to show how smart we are, and we want to, you know, get right in there and fix them. And I think it's a mistake if we don't listen to them first. So, you know, forming a relationship would be depending on that. Dabney Ewing also added a tip on that I've always followed, that he always went to the waiting room to call his next patients in. He didn't have a nurse bring them back for him and stuff, because he said you only get that one chance for a first impression, and to make the patient feel important enough that the doctor comes and gets them personally. And so I've made that a mainstay of all my patients that, you know, I'm the one that goes to the waiting room and greets them there, and we walk down to the office together. And I think there's just sometimes those little subtle things that that help form our relationship and help the patient feel that they're important enough to to have a relationship right off the bat. And then I guess in the listening of it is trying listening for listening to their language, listening to, you know, what they're finding out, what their interests are, seeing if there's some kind of common ground. I'll have a number of things, you know, in my office, you know, besides the little, you know, plaques and diplomas and things like that. There's a guitar hanging on the wall. There's a photo of one of my dogs. You know, anything that they might comment on to start the conversation off. You know, you can always tell someone when they play guitar because their eyes go right to that, and you know, I'll say, well, you know, you want to try it, and they'll take it down, and you know, you've already got a connection there before you've gotten into what they're coming here for. So, so I think there are some little things like that, but, you know, number one would be, you know, listening before dishing out advice.
And then, that's great. And then you also said taking care of yourself. Can you give a tip to do that? There's physical health, there's mental health. Is there one tip you'd tell people how to take care of yourself?
Well, you know, the same thing that we have to tell ourselves that we tell our clients, you know, in terms of the importance of eating right, of getting sleep, of getting exercise. And sometimes, you know, it's so easy for all of those things to make excuses of we don't have time for. And, you know, I think a lot of it starts with an attitude of self-care, you know, that, you know, for some people feel guilty about taking care of themselves when there's so many other people around them that need things, and, you know, having to remind them. You know, I always have this image of a mother, you know, taking food out of a refrigerator all day long, but nobody's putting anything back in. You know, eventually it gets empty and there's not anything for anybody. So unless you kind of recharge yourself or refill the refrigerator, you know, it's a very short-term, you know, approach. So I think a lot of it is just kind of an attitude of self-care needs to precede any of the behaviors. You know, we can look at the specific behaviors, like can they go walking X minutes, a number of minutes a day, and can they, you know, eat within a certain number of hours and not you know, starve themselves, and, you know, can they allow themselves enough time to sleep? A lot of pain patients have trouble with sleep, and so we've, you know, that, you know, guys at the sleep lab talk about sometimes rest being more important than sleep. So rather than stressing out, you know, if they wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's a great time to practice some progressive muscle relaxation, some mindfulness, some self-hypnosis, using that time, but changing the attitude about it rather than stressing out about how bad tomorrow is going to be because I'm not getting any sleep. So, a lot of this little self-help tips on that, with the encouragement that's something that they are able to do because they have to believe they can do it before they'll do it.
That's correct. Well, that was really helpful. I would add to that self-care is listen to yourself. That's also really important. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us. Really, really appreciate you joining us this morning. This is CenterPoint.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. With Dr. Ron Unbar.